Cacophony tells you that you're back with the Power of Three podcast on our quest to feature a story with a doctor a day in the run-up to the new series with Shuti Gatwa and Millie Gibson as the Doctor and Ruby Sunday. Today it's a second Doctor tale and we're going to be speaking with Christopher Bullis about Twilight of the Gods, a second Doctor adventure with Jamie and Victoria. Twilight of the Gods was the 26th novel in the Virgin Missing Adventures series and was originally published on the 19th of September 1996. So what does the cover blurb have to tell us? "Dominoptera," the Doctor exclaimed. "But this must be Vortis. But why are you treating them like this? They were peaceful people, not slaves. What's been happening here?" Many years have passed since the Doctor's first visit to the Web Planet, and he finds a very different world from the one he knew. A world now embroiled in a bitter interplanetary war between the opposing factions of a divided race. To restore peace, the Doctor must first resolve a deadly ideological conflict, solve the paradox of the nature of life on Vortis, and finally confront the Gods of Light themselves. As the stakes are raised, can the Doctor contain the ancient terror that threatens to devastate an entire solar system? Now, before I reread this one, the thing that struck me straight away was the imagery of Victoria dressed up as a Minoptera. And of course, she's on the cover like that, and it's the image that had stuck in my head from the original reading, where she does makeup and things like that to disguise herself as one of them. So yes, we will come to that very soon with a chat with the author. It's also a novel with a beautiful cover by Alistair Pearson, and we have the very bizarre sight of a Zarbi standing in what looks like a fruity forest. Bit of colour to it as well, which you don't quite expect after the Web Planet when it's all grey and rocks. So there we go. So without further ado, let's go and have a chat with Chris.
My name is Christopher Bullis and I wrote the missing adventure Twilight of the Gods.
Welcome back, Chris. Always a real joy to have a chat with yourself. Stumbles not included.
That's, yes, lovely to see you again, Kenny. And that's another story about the stumble.
Yes, we'll keep away from that. And why don't we
we'll
go
keep
from,
away from that one?
Yeah, why don't we go away from talking about walking a dog to giant insects? So what was it that inspired you to want to do a sequel to The Web Planet?
Well, I think the inspiration has probably been simmering in me for many years, more than I'd like to count. When both I and Doctor Who were young, I'd had in effect a triple dose of The Web Planet. You see, in 1965, the Doctor Who annual, which I was given as a Christmas present, it featured two stories which were set on Vortis, Lair of the Zarbi Supremo and The Lost Ones. The latter story seems to have been an account of the first time the Doctor landed there. I felt quite a thrill at the time. I was reading original Doctor Who stories not seen on television, and they were illustrated in colour. In particular, back then, I recall I was very taken with the Zarbi as truly bizarre-looking aliens. And in fact, I made several miniature versions of them out of plasticine and set them fighting an army of plasticine Daleks, well, why not, in a model jungle set I'd made. And although the annual was written by Doctor Who script editor David Whittaker, who was obviously deeply involved in the show, I didn't take them as canonical when plotting out Twilight. Well, that was intended as a direct sequel to The Web Planet. But those annual stories certainly reinforced the power of the original TV story in my mind. Hard to convey the impact the look of Vortis and its inhabitants had on me back in 1965. It was the most fully realised, truly alien world since Skaro, because it featured in all six episodes. Now, the acid sea and the beach of glass in part one of The Keys of Marinus were intriguing, but the action in that case did not stay there, but kept jumping about the planet. only returning there in the last episode. So its sense of place was not reinforced as the web planet was. Now, having seen interviews since with the surviving cast, I think it's clear that they were all so conscious of the special atmosphere of Vortis. Of course, it all looks very primitive now. There were shadows on the painted backdrops as well as visible joints in them, and a Zarbi collided with the camera, and there was slow pacing, line fluffs kept in, and so on. But as I said before, back on black and white, low res 405 line 1960 TV, it looked impressive to my young eyes, and it undeniably had a great imagination and ambition. I think it pushed what technical budgetary resources they had to their limits.
Absolutely agreed. I mean, even now when you watch it, there's still something quite special about it, with the music as well being that sort of distinct, the structure sonore from France. Yes. But yes, absolutely agreed. And it's definitely an alien, and it's wonderful watching it in the Blu-ray, and of course it's also on iPlayer as well these days.
Oh, it's all available there. And in fact, looking at it now, the more recent DVD I got of it, and seeing the special blurring they did for the exterior scenes on Vortis, and they blurred some of the imagery slightly to make it look more ethereal and unreal. Nice little touch. Very nice touch.
It was a little bit Vaseline around the edges of the camera, I believe it was, so there we go.
Whatever the effect was, it just made it look, and on low resolution television, even more unreal.
Yeah.
Which is appropriate. Yeah.
So how did you find building on what Bill Strutton had created for television?
Yeah, well, this is the only time I ever used an existing Doctor Who world and its inhabitants in A Missing Adventure. And partly this is for the nostalgic reasons I've already mentioned. Also because I always felt Vortis had an odd history and I wanted to expand and develop it. So I moved the setting on a few hundred years and featured another Doctor, so I was not simply rehashing the original. Now, I imagined Vortis as once being more full of life as it had been before the Animus came. I even managed to get a pen and ink black and white drawing of the reforested Vortis into the book to show what it might have looked like. I also want to explain the odd nature of Vortis, especially how creatures the size of the Monoptera could possibly fly. The Doctor eventually deduced that this was due to the absorption of the alien mineral isocrite from the soil, which, combined with the natural electric fields of their bodies and the motion of their wings, enabled them to create counter-gravitic waves. The use of the isocrite in larger scale by the Animus also enabled it to draw small objects into Vortis's orbit to become its unusual family of moons, which featured on the original television version. In the original Web Planet story, the First Doctor suspected magnetism being used, but I thought that concept was rather simplistic and needed a bit of upgrading.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that so often happens with the books, sort of with, you know, 30-odd years hindsight, as it was back then, that you're able to just update the science a little bit.
Yeah.
And give it a bit more of a modern
twist and polish. It does need that. Yes, indeed. Yeah.
Yep. So how did you find creating some new aliens with which to menace Vortis?
Well, I tried to give the Animus a kind of origin story to explain how it suddenly appeared on Vortis. Then I added the stranded Rumons, into whose system Vortis had intruded, and then the innocently meddling and truly alien being believed by the Monoptera to be their gods of light. Thinking about the interplay between these different players inspired the title of the story, which is taken from the last part of Richard Wagner's 15-hour-long operatic Ring cycle, Gotterdammerung, Twilight of the Gods. This has been borrowed by many other writers over the years. It's a handy, impactful phrase when you want to imply something significant is happening which will have major consequences. It seemed appropriate in my story, where the fate of the world was at stake, and where, at the end, quite literally, its gods are dethroned. The plot required aliens who were very different in form and thought from humans, the natives of Vortis and the Rumons, so they did not understand what they were doing had consequences for lesser beings. They were truly acting in a godlike way. They were also, as it turned out, the equivalent, in their realm, of schoolchildren. my version of Twilight is also a comment on the dark legacy of empire building and forced colonization. If you transpose 18th and 19th century Africa for Vortis, you could see the inspiration for this. It also depicts a downfall of religious obsession, the belief in absolute social structures and certainties. At the end of the book, I have the Doctor make a plea for the need for mutual respect between different peoples.
Excellent, because I think that, where I live, I'm very close to the David Livingstone Centre in Blantyre, and there's an awful lot in there about, looking at the colonialism and the like. So yes, it's something that I'm fascinated by, and just the fact that the Doctor's the one there encouraging mutual respect, which is great.
Well, one always hopes the Doctor would do that, but it's in all our histories one way or another, and it's our real legacy, and it's not hard to see how it could be repeated in other worlds and other times.
Most definitely. Now, I mentioned Patrick Trout in there. So how difficult is it to capture his Doctor in print? Because a lot of people have said it's difficult to do. So how did you find him?
Well, I've never heard that before. But then there are lots of things that pass me by. So fortunately, I wasn't put off by that. I simply approached writing for him, as I do with every other Doctor, fix an image of him in my mind and trying to capture the essential cadences of speech and most distinctive mannerisms. In fact, after I searched through my old files, I found the reference notes I created for him all those years ago. These are the key character traits, physical details and mannerisms I kept in mind while writing for it. There's a just note, you understand. Mm-hmm. A puckish, clownish hobo tramp. Vigorous hand gestures, expressive eyebrows. Clasps hands together in delight and wrings them in despair. Gentle but remorseless logic. Points out other people's errors genially. Grins and beams with evident good nature. Suddenly narrows his eyes in perception, understanding revelation. Ingenious. Makes dry observations. Occasionally exhibits exasperated frustration. Could suddenly become grave and serious, yet is also childishly playful. Slow, deliberate way of speaking. Whimsical comments, observations. When things go wrong, he exclaims, "Oh dear!" Physically, he is a small stature with a beetling mop of black hair, sharp eyes, distinctly marked jowls that Victoria has observed make him look like an intellectual but perplexed basset hound. Wears an old, dusty, grabby black frock coat with sleeves that seem a little too long for him, baggy check trousers, a loose collar, an untidy necktie. Those are my notes, the ones I worked from. In short, he was a somewhat comic, slightly disheveled wanderer through time and space, whose outward appearances and mannerisms conceal brilliance and determination and power. It's recently occurred to me that he is a little like the US TV detective Columbo, an often distracted and apparently disorganized outward persona, dressed in a tatty Mac in this instance, hides a razor-sharp mind. However, Columbo started in 1968, so he couldn't have been the inspiration for the Second Doctor, in case anybody was wondering about that.
I had no idea Columbo started that early. There you go. New fact. Thank you,
Chris. I had to check it up. When that possibility occurred to me, I thought, is there some cross-influence going on there? And so I looked it up and thought, no, Columbo was 68. So the Doctor got there first. Second Doctor, anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. And I love that line about the Basset Hound. That's very, very, very true.
Well, that seems appropriate. Yes, yes.
It does. You mentioned Victoria there. So how did you find writing for her and Jimmy?
Well, I took the same approach as writing the Doctor by creating the own sets of reference notes, which I've also dug out. Jamie's, for a start, went like this. Sometimes slow on uptake, but very practical and resourceful. Good-natured and polite in an old-fashioned way. Occasionally gloomy and fatalistic. Alert, suspicious nature. Brave, occasionally reckless, but also learning the virtues of discretion. Non-technical. Covers lack of understanding by say, "Hey, oh, aye, that." He says, "Oh, doctor," when exasperated. Vocab includes yon, that's as may be, ye ken and we. Physically brawny and compact, thick mop of dark hair, narrow sharp eyes. Wears shirt and kilt, thick wool socks with a dirk tucked into them and stout boots. Now, in Twilight, I gave Jamie a chance to interact with a greater extent with futuristic technology, which otherwise mostly baffles him, when he drove a military truck with some success. Otherwise, I allow him to be brave and dashing, always ready for a fight, but also showing compassion to the weak and downtrodden, even if they were aliens. This, to me, seemed a natural development of his character after having travelled with the Doctor for some time. Now, Victoria's character notes ran like this. Easily alarmed, a shrill screamer when frightened, can display wide-eyed panic anxiety, yet getting bolder and more confident, flashes of reserve, curious, impulsive, well-mannered and well-spoken with few vocal contractions. When she musters the courage, she can be sharp and dismissive, almost haughty, scolding when putting somebody down who deserves it, may exclaim, "Oh, that was horrible," with feeling. Physically shapely and feminine, long brown hair tied back, large eyes, clear skin, neat, smooth, almost doll-like features. Dress, 60 star, with skirt above knee, experimenting with comfortable yet attractive costume styles, discovering freedom of choice. And that's important because in my story, I was in effect preparing Victoria for departing the series in the next TV episode that would have followed on from it, which was Fury from the Deep. Now, she was getting more proactive, braver and bolder, and leaving behind her Victorian upbringing. And during her adventure on the Vortis, I was able to use her to make a wry dig about how easily she could be made up to look like a Monoptera. People may not have noticed, you know, but many Doctor Who aliens resemble humans with prosthetic bits stuck on them. The same is true for a lot of aliens in Star Trek. I've no idea why. More seriously, I was also able to use both Jamie and Victoria to employ the time traveler's ability to speak every language extant wherever they land to good effect. Their ability to communicate fluently with the Monoptera and the Rumosians, both the Imperials and the Republicans, and so translate between the locals and the invaders, drew Jamie and Victoria deeper into the story from the outset by multiplying mutual interactions. And so it progressed the plot more rapidly.
Yeah, I'm still laughing at the comment about the being made up to look like aliens. It's something they haven't done in 21st century Doctor Who, which you would almost think they would have done. Just that wry comment. It's brilliant.
Well, I thought it's just so obvious and it's such a silly thing. We know why. It was practical. It was inevitable. You couldn't have done it otherwise. And when they started and when Star Trek started, there was no CGI to create a really alien being to interact with. You have to put people in rubber costumes and try to make them as fresh and original as possible and hope it works, which a lot of the time it did, surprisingly. But in this instance, I thought, yes, great, wait a minute, I could put her in a Monoptera costume and she can be a spy in disguise and so on. I think it worked out, yeah.
Yeah, because you've developed the creatures here, and you also developed Vortis itself by revealing it was a hollow world. So where did that idea come from?
Yeah, well, that was me taking a big leap forward. The so-called gods of light and their temples, they were mentioned in the original Web Planet story, and I expanded on them. I wondered what they really were and came up with a novel explanation. In the original TV story, there seemed to be a lot of starlight and moonlight and Vortis, but no nearby sun or a proper day-night cycle. That suggested an interstellar wandering world. All those volcanic vents in the landscape implied it was kept warm by internal heat, but how long could such a natural process last, and would it be stable? Yet if Vortis was not entirely natural, what was down there? There are many hollow world stories in SF, together with images of vast futuristic cities, so any of them might have given me some inspiration. The setting I created slightly resembles the subterranean Krell city machine from the classic film Forbidden Planet, which I think I've referenced in earlier podcasts, except that my creation was much, much bigger. As it turned out, it was all built by, wait for it, electromagnetically organized plasma beings. I don't think I ever gave their race an actual name, who resembled huge living glowing clouds. They came from the core of a star cluster with a hyperspatial link to Vortis. Whole world was simply a student science project built by nerdy alien children. They were the gods of light, but they still proved to be fallible in the end. Their Project Nerve Center gave me the opportunity for an atmospheric description of the core of Vortis that was in every way the heart of the world and symbolically the crux of the story. That was what the TARDIS crew on their quest to destroy the Animus saw when they unexpectedly materialized there. The TARDIS was resting at an angle between two high slanting walls that ran down and away into the darkness on either side, like spreading roots at the base of a tree. They craned their necks. The walls were simply the lower braces for a truly immense column that disappeared up into the darkness above their heads, beyond their torch's range. Jamie guessed for its curvature that it was at least a quarter of a mile across. The depth of the part-lit gloom about them receded as he attempted to probe it, and the sensation of being surrounded by some vast structure grew. The air was dead to any noise they made. Their voices spread out and were gone without an echo. Yet it was not silent. There were slow bass rumbles and hums that took several seconds to rise and fade, and a gradual creaking, like the contraction of heated metal from a forge, but drawn out a hundredfold. The line of green light they'd seen on the scanner hung in the darkness to one side of them, also beyond the range of the torch beams, and clearly on a similar scale to the column at their backs. As they moved away from the vast column that towered over them, a second similar bar of light became visible, rising vertically until it was blurred by haze. Close by it was a glowing red ball contained in a framework whose outline was starkly silhouetted, like a sun bloated and softened by sunset, captured in a huge cage. From its top, red filaments spread out like veins, up and away, out of sight. Opposite this was a dark blue cubical shape of equally indeterminate dimensions, which glittered and sparkled mysteriously. As their eyes adjusted, they gradually discerned, interspersed with the glowing green bars and other strange objects, a forest of their gigantic columns rising up all around, dwarfing them as the mightiest oak would did an ant. The parallel was heightened by the fact that the columns threw out branches as they rose, which in turn divided until the distant roof was hidden by a veritable latticework of struts and beams whose sheer size was hard to grasp. There we are. That's an example of grandiose scene setting, perhaps. But then it was a very big scene to set.
Oh, that was lovely, Chris. I'm just when you're reading there, I'm picturing it in my mind's eye, and it's vast. I think CGI would be the only way to realise that in a huge scale.
Oh, it would now. I mean, ordinary models would hardly do it justice. It is. That's what you have it for. And they didn't have it then. And unfortunately, my budget ran to it, in words at least. I tried to capture something of the place, the atmosphere, you know, the alternate reality of it. The presence of it, and it's a setting for something really significant going on, and they get deeper into it, and yes, it is it's the core of the story where they find explanations what's going on. So yeah, it had to be sketched out as realistically as I could manage.
Well, I pictured it and it looks amazing in my mind's eye, so if it looks anything half as near as good as what you've imagined it, then I'm happy. So how do you look back on Twilight of the Gods now? And obviously, how does it sit with the pantheon of your other work?
As I now found, checking back through my old notes, the synopsis went through several revisions, and there were character scenes being added and lost. Originally, it was going to be a chase at the end, with the heroes pursuing the revived Animus across the local solar system. But eventually, for whatever reason, I kept the action solely centered on Vortis, which I think was the better option. Some recovered letters, these were pre-email days, to Rebecca Levine, who was my editor at Virgin Books at the time, also show I was not entirely happy with the story in its final form, because it hadn't quite got the intended feel to it I originally was aiming for. But at the same time, I couldn't explain exactly why I wasn't satisfied. This happens sometimes during writing process. An idea gets away from you and you simply have to live with it. This story was certainly tougher in content than some other works. There was a lot of suffering, bloodshed and sacrifice, but this was because the original Web Planet story was tough. Vortis seems to be a vulnerable world, out of place in the universe, whose inhabitants have to continually fight for their freedom against external threats. My story recounted their struggles and their final victory, although and also meant the downfall of their gods of light. More old Thar research has revealed that Rebecca encouraged me to make the gods as alien as possible. The heightened contrast with the other race in the story made sense, but now with more writing experience, I might have handled them differently. At the start of the story, I could have made them seem, by careful use of language and descriptions, to be regular humans, or at least humanoid teens, but with slightly odd names, who were getting away from boring lessons to their pet science project, with another kid meddling in it. Maybe then the revelation of their true nature and the connection with Vortis would have been even more dramatic. I'll never know if that would have worked. Overall, Twilight was a physical action adventure, which, had it ever been realised on the stream, would have needed huge costume props and model-making budgets, as we've discussed, plus a spectacular dose of special effects. But hopefully, it was also a story with several distinctive characters who helped the reader experience the interplay of personal obsessions, a clash of cultures, loss of faith, and the quest for a new purpose in their lives. I tried to sum up all this at the conclusion of the story, and the Doctor's final address to the Monoptera and the now reconciled Rumonts as the TARDIS crew prepared to depart. It is a time to leave the ways of cosmic childhood behind you, and with it all those beliefs and superstitions that have proven wanting. When you do set out on that long voyage, you must do so in unity and harmony, either for mutual protection or in preparation for judgment by races more powerful than you can imagine. Go forward bravely with open hearts and minds, but also humbly. Do not try to force your preconceptions onto others, for you still have much to learn. Maybe I shall visit your descendants in another few hundred years. I trust they will talk of your deeds proudly. But for now, goodbye. The last hands were clasped and the last goodbyes spoken. They waved, and there was an answering flurry of hands, both copper-skinned and black. The Doctor slipped into the TARDIS, and Jamie followed him. Victoria paused on the threshold to take one final look at the starry sky of Vortis and suddenly realised that she too was leaving something of her childhood on this strange world. Would that fledgling courage to choose her own destiny serve in its place? There was only one way to find out. The door of the space-time ship closed behind her, and a rising pulse of dematerialisation filled the air. Then the TARDIS was gone, leaving Vortis to fall on towards the star that grew ever brighter in its skies, falling out of the twilight into a new dawn. And that should have been all I had to say about writing Twilight of the Gods, because that was literally the end of the story. Except that if you're a writer, it doesn't always work out like that. At some point, a story gets set in print, version of it gets fixed, but that doesn't mean you stop thinking about it. When I came to reread Twilight for this podcast, at least 30 years after I'd originally written it, and I thought about reading out that excerpt, I began to wonder if it couldn't have been tweaked a little bit here and there, given a little extra polish, fine-tuned, all right, rewritten from start to finish, not just the end, but the whole book. Okay, not the whole thing, not rewritten. It might not be perfect, but it's not a bad story overall. But at least it should end sweetly with exactly the right choice of words placed just so. And there were a pair of words in those last lines of the book that began to nag at me as I reread them. Fall and falling. Technically, if the core drive's not active, then Vortis is in free fall along a particular orbit, and therefore also falling according to the laws of gravity. But that's a bit mechanistic, and falling is not a particularly lyrical word. A bit workaday, you know? Maybe sailing on would have been better, except that's a bit too serene and twee. Plunging, dropping, plummeting, hurtling, rushing, and now I'm reviving the same debate I probably had with myself nearly 30 years ago of those same troublesome words. So I take a deep breath and think again. In our sense, Vortis has had a fall. It endured a terrible war, suffered great losses, and its gods have been toppled. Metaphorically, it's still falling into the unknown and into uncertain future, and that can't be avoided. But it is also falling into the light of a new sun, which is a hopeful sign. So maybe they're not slick or fancy, but fall falling may be appropriate in the specific context. But I can never be sure. The perfect words might still be out there in some as yet unplumbed thesaurus. And I could go on in this way through the whole book, scrutinizing every page in the same hypercritical, nitpicking manner. Except that way madness lies. Stop it, I tell myself sternly. Halt, desist, shut the tome, and don't look back. So, Kenny, here's one final insight into the mind of a writer for your listeners to ponder on. We can never really let a story go. We must deliver a manuscript, hopefully on time, and get it published, and maybe it is well received. But secretly, we always know we could have done better.
You're a perfectionist, Chris. Always wanting to get the absolute maximum. And I'm not saying that that's a bad thing. I think that's wonderful.
Do struggle with that. Yes, I do. And I always going back over things and tweaking them. And yes, anyway, it's a problem. It's something I have to live with. And I always want to do better. And there we are. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think alternatively, given that the journey continues, it could almost be Vortis 1999.
Now, Vortis 1999. Oh dear. Vortis 1999. Yeah.
Except with better aliens.
Better alien. Oh, well, yes. Space 99. Oh dear. Don't get me on Space 1999. Please. That was something I was highly critical of. All that effort involved in it. And they had some of the silliest setting up. I don't know. Anyway, it was just, yes, that's another thing. I don't really want to think about that. Why it didn't last more than like 2 seasons, and Doctor Who is still with us in another regenerated form. So, yes. Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, Chris, thank you so much for taking the time to reread it and be so extensive. And thank you for the beautiful readings as well. It's lovely to hear the author performing their own work.
Well, it was a great pleasure. No, it's very illuminating to do these talks and to it makes me look back and I think things over again, and I consider a lot of other possible options. It certainly made me realize I've got a whole load of unrealized stories in note form and sometimes in complete synopsis form that never got actually produced as Doctor Who stories, and maybe in some way I'll work on trying to finish them off and get them published, possibly. It might happen. So we shall see in some form, yes.
Tell you what, Chris, we'll speak further in this matter because I know some people who might be able to help you with that.
Oh, well, that's nice to know. But
we'll
anyway,
do that off
there.
Air. We'll do that off air.
Off air, right. Okay.
Fantastic. Well, Chris, thanks once again. And thank you from the listeners again as well.
Thank you very much for this lovely experience, Kenny. Goodbye.
And thanks again to Chris for taking the time to have a chat with us, having reread the book. So, let's have a quick look to see what Doctor Who magazine had to say. This book was reviewed in issue 242 by Dave Owen, my old pal, through in Edinburgh. And he says, Christopher extrapolates well from the web planet, populating Vortis with the flower jungles which flourished before the Animus's malign influence, and also takes the opportunity to offer explanations for previous inconsistencies, such as the Monoptera's ability to fly despite their mass, a penchant for explaining the impossible being an asset when describing a rationalist like the Doctor exploring the apparently magical. Unlike the author's previous work, The Eye of the Giant, which diversifies into an imaginative second storyline just as the first is running out of steam, The Twilight of the Gods becomes unbelievable in its last 100 pages, losing the subtlety which had made it initially enjoyable. The identity of the real enemy can be easily guessed, and the Doctor's method of dealing with it seems wholly out of period as he skillfully pilots the TARDIS, as only became the norm in the 1980s episodes. But, as follow-ups go, it could easily have been far worse. The title is, after all, only a single continent away from being Twilight of the Gons. Victoria with the body of a Croton? Now that would have been a cover worth seeing. So, I think it let down Dave, but having come back to it recently, I particularly enjoyed it. Made me smile. I felt that the Doctor, Jamie and Victoria were very much true to character, and the fact that the Animus came back, well, of course it's going to be the Animus. So there we go. That's us, episode 2, out of the way. We'll be back tomorrow with a third Doctor adventure, but which one? I know. And the author knows, but I don't think we've told anyone else. So, you'll have to find out what it is. So be there or be somewhere else. As you know, on The Power of Three, we like to play out with a tune every time. So today is no different. And we're going to play out with a piece of music that was mentioned earlier on by Chris. So we're going to play out with Richard Wagner's Götterdämmerung, Twilight of the Gods. Bye-bye.